This is Anna Carmo with UN News. Pichas Gutach is from Lodz, Poland, where he enjoyed a very happy childhood before the Second World War. He survived 6 different Nazi concentration camps, a life forever changed by the traumatic events of the Holocaust. The worst moment of all was when he lost his father, mother and sister on the same day, murdered by the Nazis. In this powerful and moving interview marking this week of Holocaust remembrance at the UN, he tells Nathan Bariro that he turned almost into a nothing. Survivors, he says, can't ever run away from what they have lived. Now a Holocaust educator, he has one chief demand, a world without discrimination or hate.
We had a very happy childhood before the war. That finished immediately, and the Nazis arrived in Łódź within maybe a week or 8 days. I don't remember exactly. I was between 7 and 8. I was born in 1932. I was actually more grown up than anything because I started school when I was 3 and a half, and I started studying to become a winemaker. We were winemakers for 400 years in Poland. And this all went awry. And since then, for 5 years, I was under the yoke of the Nazis. We ran away to Warsaw because we thought Warsaw would be better. My mother and my sister and I, we went to the train station. Jews weren't allowed to use public. So we went as Christians and we went to Warsaw, and we stayed in Warsaw for 3 and a half years until the uprising, because my father was beaten up so badly by the Nazis in the beginning when they took him down to the cellars that he didn't trust them at all. So we were always hidden and we never went. We knew that Majdanek meant that Treblinka meant death, and we were hidden. And then we were in a bunker. We were taken out of the bunker, taken to my Majdanek, not to Treblinka. I lost my parents and my twin sister in my Majdanek, where they were gassed to death, murdered. And then I was in another 5 concentration camps, and I was liberated by the Russians in 1945, exactly at the end of the war, on the 8th of May in Theresienstadt, after going on a death march from Germany to Czechoslovakia.
What was the darkest moment for you during the Holocaust? And what, upon reflection, do you believe sustained you personally through the darkness?
Well, the darkest moment was when we were discovered in the bunker in Warsaw Ghetto when the uprising started on the 9th of April. We were there 3 and a half weeks in the bunker. And then when we were found out and we were taken to the Umschlagplatz to take away, I knew that we were going to die, because we knew that all the Jews in Warsaw Ghetto were going to be taken to Treblinka and going to be murdered. So that was like the beginning. It didn't happen in one kind of like a coup de foudre, as they say in French. It wasn't like in a one shot. It was a prolonged way of anger and despair. And then we were chased to the wagons, to Taken, and I was waiting, and my father was like an angel. He pushed us to the little window with the barbed wire so we could breathe, because they put so many people in that some people actually on the journey died from suffocation. And when we arrived, we didn't arrive in Treblinka, we arrived in a place called Lublin. When we got off the train, we found out it was Lublin. We didn't know where we were going. And then when we walked towards Majdanek, we were in Majdanek. My worst moment was when I can't tell you the whole story, but when we were chased into the barrack and told to undress naked, and my father was undressing, and we put our clothes on a kind of clothes place, wooden kind of thing, and then we were running naked with our hands in the air. My father was running in front. My father told me that if I'm asked, and this was before, I should say I'm 6 years older. I was a head taller than my twin sister, so I could actually pass for 16. I was 11, but I could pass for 16. And there was a man with a white coat with a little stick, and he would change people right, left, right, left, right, left. And he pushed me into a place, and I kind of finished up in a place, and there were shower heads. And I started saying my prayers, because we knew in the ghetto that the shower heads are false, and there's gas comes out, and we are going to die. So I started saying my prayers before dying. And then water came out in my place. And then suddenly, after they finished, they chased us to another barrack. They gave us prison clothes, wooden clothes. clogs and the wood and the hat and wooden clogs and things like that. And then I thought my father must be alive too, and I ran out and I started looking for my father because there was going to be a roll call. And I looked, and I couldn't find him. And then I went, I saw a man who I knew in Warsaw, because he used to come and sleep in our little kitchen at night, because he was a street person. And my father used to bring him every night to sleep there. And he brought other people to the little kitchen that we had. And they were, you know, and he wouldn't answer. I said, "Where did you see my father?" He wouldn't answer. And suddenly he raised his eyes to heaven. And I knew something bad. I didn't know he was murdered because I didn't know there was a gas chamber. I didn't know anything. And then the next day, I found out that my mother, my father, and my sister were murdered by the Nazis. And that was, it almost, I turned almost into a nothing. I felt that my life had no meaning, that I lost everything, that and then my brain did something that it actually, I became like a cocoon, you know, except from a cocoon a beautiful butterfly comes out, but I was like closed into that cocoon right through the, my brain, of course, being 11 years old, wasn't developed. The 3.5 years up to that point, I never had any education. I spent in the ghetto and with terrible things happening there. So I existed. I existed. And I had like blinkers on my eyes. I didn't think I existed because every second you could be dead. Every second there were selections and there was, and they used to beat you to death. They used to shoot you to death. They used to work you to death. I mean, everything was like, you know, the way of, they used you until you died. So the fact was, you had to make yourself invisible. And my brain, because I was young and because I didn't have that intellectual capacity, I didn't have a past, I didn't have a future, I didn't have a present anymore. So I was kind of living in a kind of inside. I didn't think of anything. I was living, and what kept me going was, I believe, that Providence kept me going. And it was I am a great believer, you know. When I see my father, I kind of see him right the way he looked for after us in the ghetto, and I liked the way he, even to the last moment, he had a sock with sugar, and he used to give the children a teaspoon of sugar with a bit of water, which he bought from an Ukrainian by taking my mother's wedding ring and giving it to them and getting a bottle of water and then pushing us to the window so that we could breathe. He was like an angel with wings, and I kept on remembering that he was the one who kept me, and that providentially, you know, he was an angel in heaven. You know, I was a Hasidic boy, and I believed in that. That what sustained me. That what kept me going.
And would you say that this ability to make yourself invisible, where did it come from?
It was something completely impromptu. It's something that I didn't know what I was doing, but I felt that I had to make, for example, when we were in Majdanek, the 3 months I was in Majdanek before I was sent to another concentration camp, we were sold as slaves to German companies. I made myself, there was a garden in front of the commander of Majdanek, wanted everything to be very clean, not like in other camps where it was terrible, the situation was terrible. We had to be very clean. They used to have selections, and people whose feet were dirty, they would take them out and shoot them or something. So the fact was that there was a little garden, and then when we went on a rappel and they started Wehrkommando, they were kind of choose people for different work commandos. I lay down on the ground, and I made myself as I was busy with a little garden. And then when people asked me, "What are you doing here?" I would say, "The Kapo, or the Lagerältester, or the Blockältester," you know, the different people who were actually German prisoners, but they were like on top of us. They were like the intelligentsia, the leaders of the administration. And you know, each block had a block leader, and it had the Stubendienst, and you know, and all these people. And each one that asked me, I'd say I would there. And most of the time, except for once or twice, I was caught to work very hard. And most of the time, I lay down and you know, and did that.
What sustained you after the Holocaust ended?
Well, that is a very interesting question, because what actually happened is that as soon as we were liberated in Theresienstadt, I have to tell you a little story, because I mean, without it, it's meaningless. We ran out to see, me and some little other young boys who still had the strength to run out after the death march, that half of us were killed on the way from Germany to Czechoslovakia. We ran out and we saw the Russian army liberated us, and they were chasing, the Czechs were chasing out the Germans that were settled by Hitler, you know, ethnic cleansing. They were chasing now from the German speaking people out of it. And we watched them. And while I was watching them, we felt sorry for them, because I felt empathy, because these people, you know, people with children, little babies, and they, it reminded me of how we were treated, and they were beaten. They were, you know, I didn't know what was going on, because I was very innocent. But you know, some of the Russians used to grab young women, take them to the little forest or whatever, and I didn't know what was going on. But I saw two horses with a wagon standing in the field. And I loved horses, so I went up and I started nuzzling them, and I started playing with them. And then I stayed there for an hour, and nobody came. So I got onto the wagon, I took the whip, and you don't hit a horse, you just show it the whip. And I took the reins and I started pulling them left and right, and the horses started running. And then I went into Theresienstadt, into the town, and I appropriated those horses, and the horses became my family. And I never, for the next 10 years, I never ever thought about the Holocaust. My brain did something that it made me not think about anything. I didn't think about my family. I didn't think about anything. I lived again. I lived in that moment. I think that the way, of course, 10 years later, I started suffering very badly. And then 1955, I was having lunch in a restaurant on the Sabbath, because in those days, restaurants in Israel were closed, and you had to buy on Friday, you had to buy a ticket to get your lunch. And I fainted in that restaurant, in a Hungarian restaurant, eating goulash. I'll never forget it. And from that night on, that time, I started having the most terrible nightmares. And I suffered very badly. And for years and years and years, I suffered. And it was Dorothy, my wife, who I married, who I found eventually in Jerusalem and married, she kept me alive. She's the one who saved me. I am alive today because she looked after our children. She helped me, you know, when I was screaming at night, and I was very poor. I had to work every day to bring food on the table. And so the thing is that it's difficult to say what sustained you afterwards. Of course, I thought a lot about everything, but it was you suffered. You suffered and suffered and suffered. It took a long time. And it was only when I met Stephen Smith and we went to Poland and I said Kaddish and El Mola Rachmim at a mound of ashes in Majdanek, that somehow or other it helped me to come to terms, and I started recovering, you know. And it was really, actually, it was from 1975 onwards that I started recovering and being able to live, and started working better, getting promotions and kind of, you know, still working very hard to bring a living, but I was being promoted wherever I worked, and I started feeling much better. So You come to terms with it, but the Holocaust is right inside you. You can't run away from it. It's part of you. It's going to be with you for the day until the day you die. And if you have a soul and the soul, you know, goes to heaven or wherever it goes, I mean, that soul is still going to remember the Holocaust.
Would you say that there was a desire to live, to tell your story?
No, I didn't think of telling my story. No, I didn't. I didn't want to speak because I spoke once in 1967 and I suffered so much afterwards. It became so much worse that I had to have psychiatric help to help me. So I decided not to speak about it at all, because speaking about it brought back all these images, because I have a photographic memory, and everything was kind of reliving the ghetto, the times in the concentration camps, the different, being in Buchenwald and seeing people being carnivores. There was no food in Buchenwald, especially only for youngsters. The German administration was now in the hands of socialists and communists, so when they saw the youngsters, like people in my age, they would give you a potato or something. But there was cannibalism in Buchenwald. And fortunately for me, I wasn't there for a long time. I was only there for maybe 2-3 weeks. I don't even remember how long I was in Buchenwald. I know that I left Buchenwald, that I was there. I've got the documents from Buchenwald, and I was there on the 21st of January, because that's when they took my names and they had my names and everything, but they registered me again in Buchenwald, and so I've got the documents. But the fact was that I wanted to live a normal life. So for the first 10 years, my brain gave me a kind of break, and it said, okay, don't remember anything. It was only from 55 onwards when I fainted, and I don't know, and my brain kicked in again, and having all together all the time, depending enormous amount on my wonderful wife, who we've been married now for since 1957, and we still love each other as much as before, and it was thanks to her that I actually survived, and that my kids are okay. I didn't tell them everything. They only learned from my full story when it was recorded here by Professor Paula Draper in 1992 or 93. And then we all went to Poland with Stephen Smith when he made the documentary The Void, and that it was really transforming both our, they learned about my past, we became much closer as a family, and it was something. But especially, and that's when I started, you know, healing, slowly, slowly healing, and being able from 98 and so forth, and later on, to become an educator, become telling my story and being involved in education about the Holocaust. I am a satisfied individual. I can't say I'm a happy individual, because I think it's very difficult for a Holocaust survivor to be happy. I think the ability of spontaneous happiness, my happiness and my love, expresses itself in fear.
So Pinchas, please, what would be the message that you have for the young people of today, the youth of today?
When I go to a school and when I tell them my story, I finish off as follows, and I would like to hand this message over to the world. I carry a torch. Like an Olympic torch. Now, the Olympic torch has got one flame, and it's a flame of goodwill among sportsmen. That the sportsmen should compete in a polite way, in a nice way. They shouldn't kind of fight. They should compete like human beings, like, you know, relate to each other, you know, in a sporting way. And that's what represents that torch. My torch has got more than one flame. I have a torch, which I want to give, which I give to the children, and I want to give to the world. And my torch has got more than one flame. It's got many flames. And to give you just an example of some of them, my torch has got no racial discrimination, no religious discrimination, no homophobia, no xenophobia, and above all, no hate. Hate is vicious. Hate is pernicious. Hate creates vengeance. Hate is something that should disappear from the world because it brings about vengeance. These are the torch with all these different flames which I hand over to the world, which I hand over to you. You walk around with this flame and light up the world with these beautiful words, with these beautiful flames. Bring light to the world. Make the world a better place and make it shine. This is my message to the world. Please take those flames and make them flame and make the world a much better place than it is at the moment.